And you notice that I've been getting the audio stuff all up to date. I can tell you basically what your project is supposed to be in a few moments. There's not too much to it. Your midterm project is basically to drive Dexter. Not completely. To provide the input to drive it, and that means I want you to find those and these, where these can be lane markers. These don't have to be in one piece. They might be multiple. They might be different colors. And this can be regarded as a large white line that you might encounter at a intersection. You know, the line for stopping. We gave you 2,432 test images. You may use any or all. Well, you should use at least one. And I'll be very impressed if you use all 2,432 images. Now, I think that the images that we used for the previous, I think it was Project 2, where we just evaluated different edge operators. Those are good places to start. The problem is that all you did in Problem 2, or Project 2, is you came up with all kinds of lines. There could be shrubbery. There could be all kinds of other stuff in here. You have a lot of stuff in the image. What I want to know is, how might you get this information? There's not one answer. Yes? Oh, you can use the same Project 2 images. Yes?
But the ones that are on the spot,
they're a subset. The ones that were used for a Project 2 are a subset. We didn't want to give you 2,432 images. We thought that might have been a little intimidating in Project 2. It's not for Project 6. Similar? I will check back then. Let me check with the person who collected the data. But he's out for a couple days. But you can use the Project 2 data. But I think you can maybe get some hints, though, as to how you might go about doing this. And by the way, I don't expect that everyone's going to do it the same way. I don't expect that you're going to have the same result. You may decide, oh, I'm only going to detect solid lines. I'm only going to detect solid white and yellow lines. I will only detect lines that converge together. There's a whole bunch of ways. And your results will be documented in a 6-page paper. Standard IEEE 2-column conference paper format. Oh, yes, they're all stationary. There should be 2,432 stationary images. All taken, I forget, what, 10 seconds or a tenth of a second apart or something? Yes. No, they're not animated. Okay, I'll take a look. Those were the ones that were supposed to be. But as I said, you can get started with the straight sections. You will have all kinds of fun. There is trees. There are trees. There is shrubbery. There's all kinds of nasty things. Shadows. there are breaks in the lines that will cause you to lose them. That's why, for example, we were looking at things like the Huff transform. And by the way, there is a MATLAB Huff transform routine, if you look for it. I'm not sure that it's in the image processing toolbox, but it is available. We're going to talk about the canny operator today. Canny operator is one of the things that Simon Nelican talked about when he was here in class. Remember, his goal was he was just looking for images. And there are, we're going to be talking over the next couple lectures, probably at the beginning of each, a little bit about how might you go about identifying lines. He used basically a line crawler. Once you got rid of most of the stuff, he wanted something that was straight. Well, what constitutes straight? That's a very good question. Okay, let's take a look now at what a canny operator does. Anyone ever use a canny operator, heard of it, other than Simon Nelican's talk? Okay, a couple. It's actually not too bad. This is really a fairly simple concept, but it works very well. And we looked at the Huff transform last time, and he has used the Huff transform. That could be an approach you want, because remember, what the Huff transform is good for is finding lines in images. So, for example, and we'll skip how that actually works, unless you have a question. Okay. These were examples here of the Huff transform being used to find lines corresponding to the edges of roads. Now that's because, not because of color lines, which you might have in the DARPA stuff, but simply because of change in coloration. Because what you have is, this is an infrared image. It's, and in fact, infrared is very nasty, because typically it gets cold at night and warm during the day, and its temperature changes. But it's almost always different than grass, which is next to it. And that's the kind of thing that you see here. But notice, it comes up with a line which is independent of, well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say independent of, which does not have any holes in it. So there are things which you could do. I talked last time a tiny bit about generalized Huff transforms. That could be applicable to looking at lines that are at only certain angles. There are ways to do this. Now, we started Gesundheit, a little bit the last time talking about segmentation. Image segmentation is a really simple thing, and we did it on two color images. It is a technique that you might conceivably use with your line following. You have multiple information. Remember, the previous edge information that you constructed in project number 2 was based on the intensity image. It was not based on color information. Now, you might want to do your edge information in color, or you might want to compute your edges for a color image. But maybe instead what you want to do is, maybe you want to segment your image first. Maybe you want to find the white or the yellow, which could conceivably correspond to a potential lane marker. Then maybe match it up with an edge. And remember, the way that Simon's work worked was, and I, you know, we won't get to how he came up with these, but somehow he had routines which extracted a continuous boundary for an object. That was done using combinations of Huff transforms, and we'll talk about canny operators today. And basically, he crawled along each of these until he found a big change in the direction, called that a corner point, and then went on and connected his straight line segments. Now, this is chapter 10 material, where you do line following, line models, and stuff like that. This is also chapter 10 material. This is black and white, but you could apply it to color. That's what we did in last lecture's example. Now, color, you do it almost like Photoshop, where you take a sample, and like in last lecture, what we do is we look for the difference in color. If it's close to our target color, then we simply say, then that belongs to that object. What I'm going to talk about here is just the concept of what does it mean to belong to an object. That's what segmentation is all about. We've never really talked about it in great detail. Typically, you would look at this and say, wow, this is one object. Now, this is pretty easy. It's white on black. And you would simply, the best way is you would look at the histogram. And this is potentially a histogram of the object we just looked at. You know, number of pixels with that value of gray versus the grayscale value. So we have probably the white object, the black background. You could very easily look at it and say, okay, everything with a grayscale value above here must belong to the object. Everything with a grayscale value below this must belong to the background. Typically, you have an object and a background. Conceivably, you could have a more complicated histogram, and you might have two objects, or this might be one, and you have to analyze your picture. This is usually background. Now, let me back up and point out something. The key thing that makes this all one object is that these are all connected. What does connected mean? Well, that usually has a very simple image or a very simple idea. We talked about this earlier. Connected means if this is the pixel at XY, I look around it and I simply say, do I have north, south, east, west neighbors? This is for connectivity. And that works good for large, fairly complete objects like this. What will change is you'll get jagged boundaries. Okay? Because obviously, if there were a pixel here that were the same color or intensity, that would not get counted. A typical approach, and we'll talk about these segmentation algorithms later, is you usually, well, there's two approaches. One is if you have some candidates, you just start there and start linking pixels, and basically you construct a data structure like a linked list or something. That's okay, but it lends itself to a very complex algorithm and data storage requirements. Usually a simpler way to do it is what we call a bottom-up, top-down blob coloring algorithm. I start up here, and if it's zero, I call that the background, and I basically just scan back and forth until I come up with with a couple pixels here that would have a value of one. It's an object. You know, basically I'm saying you either are of the right color or the right intensity or you're not. If you're not, you're background. If you're of the right color, then you're potentially a member of this object. So if you're potentially a member, we label you one. And let's take a look at this algorithm in a little bit more detail. And for example, maybe that is of the right color and this pixel is of the right color. And what would happen as I start coming along is all of these are not of the right color or intensity. So they're zeros and I don't do anything with them. Now, I come along here and all of a sudden I find the first pixel of interest. It might be the right color or the right grayscale. And I say, oh, okay, this will be object number one. Question, is it connected to a previously known object? No. Then it gets a brand new object number. So I identify it or color it as an object. There's nothing over here, so I continue. Okay, zero, zero. I find a new pixel potentially belonging to an object. It's not previous, because what I do is I just look at the adjacent pixels. And if I'm using 4 connectivity, it's just the top and bottom. If I'm using 6 or 8, it might include this one. But you see, it's not connected to any previously known one. So I'm going to give it a new color, 2. And maybe these come down like this. And we'll make it really hard. We'll connect them there and then come down like that. Okay, but you see, I'm going top to bottom, left to right, and I come along, start again. Oh, I get here. Now, your first reaction would be, oh, okay, that's a new object. I'll call it 3. But no, it's connected to an object whose label is already 1. So, okay, I'll continue the label 1. I come along, and there's nothing connected here. I come here. Ah, okay, that's connected to color 2. Okay, now, here's where things get interesting. Look at what happens down here. I start the next row. Here, the first one, I recognize that it's colored or connected to the one above it. It gets the same color. I move over one. Oh, that one's connected to, now, also by 4 connectivity, the one to the left of it. This is also a 1. I come over here. I keep going. Now, one of the interesting things is you get here and say, what do I do? Do I give it a 1 or a 2? Actually, it doesn't matter. You just give it whichever one it comes to first. If you look up, okay, then you give it a 2. But we create something new. Up to now, we had a blob coloring table. Basically, we had colors. Now, we have an equivalency table. And basically, what this table says is, oh, this 2 pixel is connected to 1 and 2. Therefore, 1 equals 2. Data structure is getting a little more complicated. And then I would come along and, oh, 0, 0. Okay. Now, this was a really, really simple example. But what we, and it has, well, we won't get algorithm, but what's usually done is this is the top down, or what we call pass one. What we typically will do is we'll then do a bottom up pass, where we'll start down here, go across, and move up. And what will happen is this will often find equivalencies and connections which we didn't have before, depending upon the kind of method that you're using. Uh-oh. That's not, I hope, too bad. Okay. But it's very common to do a top-down, bottom-up. And so maybe if you're looking for white, what you would do is all colors close to the white that corresponds to the markers on the road, the markings on the road, and you might do this to connect them. You see, what we're talking about is We need a way to get rid of a lot of data that's in the image. There are multiple ways. It might be that, okay, we run some kind of edge operator and get stuff like that. Okay, so here's a whole lot of candidates. You might get really sophisticated and say, oh, I will only have an edge line if I have a edge and the interior is a certain color. Now think about how easy that would be to implement. That's actually fairly complicated because you need to know what's the interior of an object. Or you could think about color gradients and say, okay, I'll call the interior always the direction in which the direction returned by the gradient, which is in the direction of greatest change. That you have to think about this, and I'm not promising you that all of these. If you have enough computer time, and I mean that literally, that you don't have to do this stuff in real time, you can do anything. The question is, what can you do which is simple and fast? And that's where cleverness comes in. Okay, so segmentation is usually a very good thing. Maybe you pick a couple colors, and that's adequate, and you don't even run a gradient operator. Maybe you just run something to collect all the pixels which are connected to each other, one of these labelings, and that's it. But you probably, at some point, have to fit a line to your data to see if it matches an acceptable value. That would be an ultimate filter. So, this is taking Chapter 10 stuff, mapping it to the kind of stuff that you've been doing. We're not going to get too much into this. This is really Chapter 10 stuff. But what happens when you have a varying reflectance? Okay, objects aren't the same color across them. Roads tend to be, because usually they're illuminated by the sun. So usually it's okay, but depending on the time of day and shrubbery, this was a major problem if you totally rely upon color. Remember I talked about the Carnegie Mellon Nav Lab back in the 70s? The reason why that graduate student was walking behind it with a ripcord on the emergency stop was they used color for everything. It really would get very messed up when you went into a shadow, and it would follow the wrong edge of the road into the ditch. Not very good. So think about that. Segmentation, I'll just mention a couple things. Usually you have to look at the histogram. There are methods of intelligently thresholding things, automatically picking out where the threshold should be. The ideal thing is if they're very far apart, black and white. And you see, you can tell this is an original image with a shadow. And the idea is you want to pick the threshold so that these pixels are not included. And that would probably correspond, since that's on the dark side, to maybe a tail in here or something. But there are actually intelligent algorithms. A lot of them are based on probability statistics, but some are based on artificial intelligence and other responses. This is actually a very good one that works really, really well. Fingerprint analysis. Anyone ever, not that you've had your fingerprints taken by the police, but have you ever looked at fingerprints? I mean, they're really very interesting. There's usually a lot of little noise in there. Depending on what you do, you can get holes and gaps which aren't real. This is a very fine image processing problem. This is done with segmentation, and what they did was, in essence, they had a you want to think of it as a simple AI program, it moves the threshold around to find the right point between the black and the white. And I'll tell you, there's a very, very simple statistical interpretation. If this is the probability density function of the background, and this is the probability density function of the object, what you do is you pick the point where they cross each other. And that gets into decision theory and all kinds of stuff, but it's very simple. You want to maximize the probability that it's one or the probability that it's another. And if those are probabilities, where they equal is where you should put your decision point. When there's nothing in the middle like this, you have a range. Now, with something like this, which is not real time, you can iterate. You can have the computer move back and forth. You can be sitting there watching it interactively. You don't always have that option. Now, this is something that we usually don't get to in this class, but since Simon Nelikan mentioned it so much, we're going to talk about it. The canny edge operator. The images that he was processing didn't have very many edge points in them. And one of the reasons is basically that he applied this operator to the gradient image. And actually, it didn't have to be a gradient. It could be a Sobel operator or any of those other derivative operators. Okay, those give you a grayscale image. It goes from 0 to whatever the maximum, well actually I shouldn't even say 0, it goes from minus to plus, whatever the range of your derivatives are. You can have a plus slope or a minus slope. Let's scale it and I'll fit it into our 0 to 255. You still have a grayscale image. Where are the edges? And that's what the canny operator is all about. Very first thing, and this will come up as soon as I move to Fourier transforms in a little bit. Okay? Smooth the edge with a Gaussian filter. What this does is there can be a lot of high-frequency noise. Maybe it could be from leaves. Basically, what you're doing is, if you're interested in the road, which is a large object, there is absolutely no sense in keeping small information there. Average it out and get rid of it. It also gets rid of a lot of noise. It can reduce, though, your signal level. You know, if that were just an intensity, a white on a gray, and you average it, that's going to decrease the white level. So the contrast will go down. But smooth the image with a Gaussian filter, and you have to play to find the right size kernel to use. It should be below the size of the objects you're looking for. You compute the gradient magnitude and direction. Sobel, Laplace, well, no, you don't want Laplace, but any of the directional derivative operators. Because you need an X and a Y. You want to actually, in this case, we want both the magnitude of the change and the direction of the change. It's important to have both. Now, these are what look impressive. Big names. Non-maximal suppression. And the other one, double thresholding. It turns out this is not a big deal. I'm going to tell you what non-maximal suppression is. The idea is, basically, you want to follow the ridge line of a mountain range. In other words, if you've got a mountain range, I guess I'm not very good at drawing one, okay, and maybe we have a whole lot of mountains. Basically, we want the line that follows the peak of the range. We want the highest point, the point at which we have the greatest change in the derivative. And so we just follow along the top. It's like if you would look at a topographical map where we might have the brightest and then It will decrease, and let's make things a little more interesting. You know, it would come back in your image, all you would get is that. The line where the maximum changes occur. That's what it is. And so what the non-maximal suppression is we want to thin everything to keep only the largest values, which are connected. And it occurs by us restricting ourselves to directions. Okay? We're going to look at four possible directions. And there's nothing really too much to it. We're going to look that way. We're going to look that way. The two 90-degree directions. North, south, east, west. And then we'll do the two diagonals. And if we're looking at this point in here, MIJ, if MIJ is not the largest value along one of these directions, we're going to set it equal to zero. In other words, we're going to throw it away. Otherwise, we're going to keep that value. We're not going to set it necessarily to 1 or 0, but we're going to keep what its value was. So it needs to be a maximum in one of those directions. That's all non-maximal suppression is. Double thresholding. Double thresholding is, let's think about an image, a complicated image, and not all gradients will be the same value. Let's suppose there actually was some kind of mountain range or something going along, makes an L shape like this. And it may be that maybe it's not very steep here and very steep. Very mountainous at these ends. There's going to be a big difference in the derivatives, in the change in the derivatives in slopes at those points. So it may be that if we apply a single threshold to this, what we might get, let's say that our operator, our non-maximal suppression, returns all of these. But what we do, first threshold, we apply a high number. If we're going to, and let's just assume it's normalized to 0 to 255 for the edge image. So maybe we'd pick a threshold of 225. And that might say, okay, after I threshold it, I pick up that line and that line. But because these are all much weaker slopes, much smaller changes, the single threshold doesn't get them. Nothing's here. So what you do in the double thresholding is you say, oh, I come along, just like I was doing in that labeling, I follow a line. Okay, this is great. I get to here. There's nothing else potentially connected to it. I look to the east. I look to the west. I look in all the possible directions. There's nothing. So what do I do? It may be that we have a dynamic range issue because derivatives can vary a lot. So what I do is I have a second threshold, which is much lower. Maybe it's 75. So what I do is when I reach the end, I dynamically drop my threshold. And I look around and say, okay, is there a maximum here that isn't as strong but still above this threshold and connect it to this point? And yes. And that's how you can often connect them, these. So the double thresholding idea isn't a very difficult thing to implement, and it works quite well. And I'm going to show you not some roads, but some images that I found on the web. And there are tons of websites which illustrate these different image processing algorithms. This is from one in England. For some reason, I think the English have better educational websites on computer vision algorithms. This is a canny operator. Here's a fairly complicated image. And this is, they applied a Gaussian filter to that image. The Gaussian had a sigma of 1. That's how wide the Gaussian is. So it gets rid of small details. And then they used a really high and a really low threshold. And this actually did a fairly good job. Notice it picked up patterns in here. You may say, well, gee, this doesn't look any different than those images that you did in project number 2. But let's take a look at what we have. Remember, we've tried to get connected lines as much as possible. That has a lot of detail. Let's see what happens if we vary the parameters. This changes the thresholds. That's this range that's acceptable here. And the second threshold, which was way down here, is now up here. And notice, it behaves exactly like what you think. There's a lot fewer lines that are candidates. And maybe you could implement this instead of linking by just the derivative, it links by color. A canny color operator might be interesting. Here's some others. We lower the threshold, period. We lower the upper one dramatically, and we move this one back down. So it's picking up a lower range, and you can see, and this is where it comes in, you've actually got some weaker edges in there, some thinner ones. And then here, this is what happens when you change the Gaussian. How wide that is, let's go back and look at that. Look at the detail there. And notice what happens if I filter it with the Gaussian. You see, you have to know the scale of what it is that you're looking for. And I think that there are some pretty good standards on how wide lane markers have to be. I don't think that the Department of Transportation will let you use ones that are 1 millimeter wide. They also probably would not tolerate ones that are 1 foot wide. What is the actual width? 2 or 3 inches? Anyone know? Okay. Well, California's always a little different. I figured they might have done something, you know. Nothing against California. Yes?
Is it pure coincidence that when the Gaussian was at 2 and the first threshold was at 128 that it looked the same?
Pure coincidence. That's where this is not a job necessarily that can be totally automated unless you have some characteristics of what you're looking for. But it may be, you know, I'm not asking you to write an AI program. Although if you do, that would be spectacular. You know, some kind of neural net feedback, or maybe you would have maybe a rule-based system or something. There's all kinds of ways that you could do that, but if you have some idea, I think, of the scale of what you're looking for, and if you find it in a couple images, one of the questions that you could ask yourself as a good graduate student is, how well does this algorithm work for all 2,432 images? You know, you get it started on one, and you collect data on all, well, that's an awful lot for you to do. Maybe for your dissertation would force you to do that. But if you were just doing it for a paper in here, you might say, let's take 20 sample images and ask ourselves, did it work for all 20? You know, one of the things that engineers always want to know is how well did something work? Under what conditions did it work? And you may say, okay, it worked for 17 out of the 20, and the reason it didn't work in the other three is due to changes in the color. The whites were no longer white, or they went to yellow. Okay. As long as you can explain why it didn't work. Now, there are related techniques which are similar to this, but they're not the same. One of my favorites is edge relaxation. This is a recursive technique. And basically what it says is, let's do the following. Let's take our picture, and maybe like we did before, we recognize that we've got different strengths of edges in here after running an edge operator. What we do is we simply give every pixel, basically we take this image, which was a gradient, we normalize the whole image to the maximum gradient in the image. Okay, so all values go between 0 and 1. And what we say is, well, since it goes between 0 and 1, that's the probability that it's an edge. Probably the strongest gradient in the picture is an edge, corresponds to an edge pixel. Probably the weakest is a non-edge. So there's a probability concept. And what you do is you say, and this is very similar now to the canning, if I'm between two strong edge pixels, I'm going to increase my probability. If I'm not between two, then I'm not. If I'm at the end of a line, I'm going to lower my probability. And it gets into all kinds of cases. If you have a situation like this, where this is an edge, and this is an edge, but there's sort of a weak edge in here, we increase its probability. On the other hand, if it has the same strength, but there's no edge here, we lower its probability. If you see where I'm going with this, it's basically, what am I connected to? You might even argue this is more of a biological approach. And you can, and I'm not going to get into all of the details. There's some early papers, but the idea is you can just do it over and over until every pixel in the image is either a 0 or a 1. And you can do things that result in, whoops, not that one. This shows just all the special cases. This is what you might start with. These are two images that might have been processed by a Sobel or whatever. We've done the magnitude, and you can see you have all kinds of incomplete lines. And what you might say is, okay, I want a complete edge picture. I will apply this edge relaxation to it, and notice how it comes along and fills everything in. Now the problem is, this may give you too much information. That's the problem with edges. You'd like to have a magic algorithm named after yourself, of course, okay, which you put in on one end, the lane mark, well, you put in the complete color image that DD or Dexter or whatever sees, and what we want coming back is just the lane markers. In fact, ideally, we just want the equation of them. Someone eventually will translate that equation into real 3D coordinates. But that's ideally what we would like. So, you can do a lot of things. If you want more reading about these algorithms, you can find them in Chapter 10, and we'll come back and take a much more coherent overall look at these algorithms after we do Fourier and image restoration. And I think that's it for that particular one. And I'll put those slides up on the web. Okay, any questions on those? You're going to rush out and use all of these techniques, solve the world's problems, and, you know, we may have the Bill or the Norman or, you know, Brad or whatever algorithm. You know, if you develop it, you can name it after yourself. Okay. Now, one of the big concepts which we have been ignoring, how many people in here are not engineers, computer scientists? Oh, okay, we have at least a couple of you. Good. Well, we like computer scientists. There's nothing wrong. But you may have skipped courses which had Fourier transforms in them. Don't worry. We're not going to do as much math as I could. We'll save that later for eigenvalues and eigenvectors and that kind of stuff. But right now, we want to go through Fourier transforms. And some of this is going to be background. And it turns out that there are some excellent routines built into MATLAB. I'm very sure that ImageJ has also Fourier routines, because everyone uses Fourier routines. And the idea of Fourier routines, well, the idea of Fourier period, is that we're going to take a complex signal or a complex image and represent it as a sum of waveforms which are integrally related, you know, frequency f, frequency 2f, etc. And we sum them with various coefficients, and you can get things that look like that. But the idea of representing a waveform by a series, I'm getting chalk all over my trackpad. I've been through this before. I couldn't make it work. Okay, let's hope it doesn't get too bad. Okay. The ordinary mathematical definition of the Fourier transform in one dimension. And most of you should have, actually I think all of you should have seen it someplace in your education. Now, typically, and I'm going to be a little bit different, probably all of you saw it with t here as the variable, time. That's typically where you used it. And the variable here was usually omega. And it was between time and frequency. We use different notation in image processing, because images are space functions. So instead of time, we have space. X is our standard horizontal dimension. U is the corresponding frequency. And instead of units of hertz, it has units of cycles per distance. In other words, it could be cycles per millimeter or cycles per meter. It's a spatial frequency. Now, that's in one dimension, and you've probably seen these things, which I'm going to show to you in a few minutes with images. But this is the classic example taken out of every 246 level textbook, every introductory Fourier book. And here's my x, here's my f of xy, and it's a simple pulse. Okay? What we will change it into shortly would be a white line in an image. But in one dimension, it's just a pulse. And without going through all the mathematical evaluation, what happens if you do compute the Fourier transform by that integral that I gave you, and it turns out, it comes out to be a complex number. We don't have the most elegant ways of plotting complex numbers, so what we usually do is we'll plot the magnitude of the complex number. That works most of the time. And if I plot the magnitude of the Fourier transform of that pulse, I get the so-called sinc, the sine x over x type function. Now, key thing, what happens when we do this in two dimensions. And it turns out it's really simple. First of all, look at the formula. All I'm going to do is add another term. Instead of f of just x, it's f of x and y. Previously, it was e to the minus 2, or j 2 pi ux. I simply added the product. And this is important. We're basically making a fundamental assumption that it's going to be a product of x and y. And that makes life very easy for us. Now, don't worry. You're never going to have to compute these. MATLAB has great routines for doing these for you. There are great fast routines, the FFT, the DFT. You'll be using all of those. Now, the function that we can put in here and try is the two-dimensional equivalent of that pulse. It's a square pulse in x and y. And if I look at this in an image, what is it? It's basically a white rectangle on a black background. It's one, well, they call it A here, but it's basically one there and zero everywhere else. It's a white rectangle on a black background. And notice what the Fourier transform of it looks like. It's that sinc function in two dimensions. Now, if it's square, it'll be exactly the same in U and V. If it isn't square, it will have a different frequency in each dimension, in each axis. Usually what we do in image processing, by the way, that's also the magnitude. What we usually do in image processing is instead of doing a 3D surface plot like that, we plot the vertical dimension as the intensity. So this is an image, in essence, looking down on this surface. And so right here, where it's the highest, it's the brightest white. We'd make that our maximum white. And then you can see the ripples go off, and it doesn't show up in here. This is actually a scan of a crummy cut. The book is good, but the illustration in the book isn't so good. So it's not a great illustration. But these go from bright to dark. And by the way, I'm going to tell you a bunch of little tricks about MATLAB. Some of the issues to properly display a Fourier transform in MATLAB. It's not the easiest thing to work with, but it's mostly because even though I started with this, basically values of 0 and 1, I can have a very large range on this. I don't know what the vertical is, and I may have to rescale it to 0 to 255. And it's not immediately obvious how you do that. There's also an issue of, and you may have missed it in some of my first lectures of the course, remember when we were doing intensity transformations? You may need to rescale it to make it look this good. And you actually usually use a log transform of the intensity. So there's a lot going on. But we can reduce it to one line of MATLAB. Maybe one line of image J. I hope so. You'd better. But we want the 2D routines. Now, some important concepts. Let's just look at one axis. And one of the big things is how things scale. And if I have M points, and I make, well, this would be the transform corresponding to this rectangle or that pulse. It looks like that. What happens when I scale it? I'm just going to make it bigger. So I'm making my white rectangle in my picture bigger. What happens? Normally, you intuitively think, oh, it should get bigger also. No. This is more sort of like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's like the change here times the change here, that is the units, equals 1 over the number of points. very similar to a Heisenberg uncertainty. If you make this bigger, these get narrower. They become closer together. And that'll show up in a bunch of images we're going to show you. Now, I've been skipping all the math. And I think this is the first place where I want to make sure that I don't skip the math anymore. Okay? What I want to talk about just a little bit is, first of all, some of the terminology. The more detailed math is in my notes. That's okay. But in general, if I start out with something like this, notice, this is a rectangle, okay? And you can even, this is great, you can even count the number of pixels if you wanted to, okay, that it has. But the key thing is that if we do the Fourier transform, the f of u and v, it's a complex number. And we, if we follow our book's notation, would represent it as a real part and an imaginary part. By the way, we have any physicists in here or any people that trained as physicists? I'm always using the J for my square root of minus 1. And our textbook does, and most image processing textbooks I know do. Okay, now, a couple things. The first thing is what's normally called the Fourier spectrum. And that's usually what we plot. And it's actually the magnitude of this f of u and v. You have to be careful which routine you're using and what it's going to give you in MATLAB or ImageJ. If it gives you a complex number output, you're going to have to convert it to a magnitude. So the Fourier spectrum is the square root of r squared uv plus I squared uv at each point. So that's called the spectrum. Now, you can do a phase angle. It's rarely used. And it's just like you would expect. It's the imaginary divided by the real part. Now, one other important thing, that was the Fourier spectrum. And that's based on magnitude. You'll often find a power spectrum. And all it really is the magnitude squared. So this would be often called P of UV, and that would be the real part squared plus the imaginary part squared. And the only difference here, if you want to think about it as a circuit, if this would correspond to a voltage, the square of it would correspond, if you have a known resistance, the square of the voltage V squared over R would correspond to power. So that's why be careful when you talk about spectrum, whether you're talking about the Fourier spectrum or the power spectrum. And all there is that square, but there is a little bit difference there. Now, another thing that happens an awful, awful lot is where is our image? And it turns out that usually you notice where I'm showing the axes in the UV plane, in the Fourier transform, zero would normally be here. And think about what happens if I would just grab this and move it up there. And I'm going to show you some images like that in a moment. We almost always display it centered. It's easier for us to interpret, I think. It's the standard way to do it. But to shift the Fourier spectrum from what would be the origin to an artificial origin, you have to multiply it by something before you transform it. And you may have to deliberately put this in your MATLAB or ImageJ program. If you end up with your spectrum with all the bright stuff in the corners, you've forgotten to translate it. Now, it turns out that a translation in the frequency domain, and you can look this up, corresponds to a multiplication in the space domain. Actually, a shift, but we'll get into how you do that. But if we have a function, f of xy, what we would like to do is we would like to get a u and a v that shift it to the center. So if we have an m by n, we want to move it by m over 2, n over 2. Okay? So we do a shift. And this is just a m by n image size. And we always have it, if I have a 512 by 512 in the space domain, I always have a 512 by 512 in the frequency domain. That is the way the Fourier transform algorithm works, EFT. Now the question is, before I get the blue screen of death here, I'm sorry, that's another computer. The question is, what do I have to do to the Fourier transform? I have to remember how I do my really fancy scripts. Okay. The Fourier transform, what do I have to do to this to get that, which is what you really want to display? Well, it turns out you multiply it by minus 1 to the x plus y. It's not immediately obvious that that's what you should do, but it is. And I can prove it to you, and it is in the notes. It's a very simple derivation. But if you put this translation into the definition of the two-dimensional Fourier transform, okay, what happens is you get terms like this. And what do the terms in the exponent look like? E to the minus j 2 pi ux, things like that. E to the j 2 pi, e to the minus j 2 pi. Turns out those are multiples of minus 1. So it comes about because I do require this in the frequency domain. Now, we used to require you to figure this out on a homework or on an exam. Since there's no exams in here and I haven't been doing any homework, I may as well go ahead and tell you. Okay, so that's a little bit of all kinds of background. There are some great properties of the Fourier transform. The first one is the shift. These are things that if you've studied Fourier transforms, you know about. Maybe you've heard it in a lecture, etc. The first one is the shift, my simple image. And if I take the Fourier transform of this, and see what happens? It appears in the corners. If you don't put in the shift by doing this or by other techniques, this is what you get. If you put in the shift, you get it centered exactly like you think. And this corresponds to the lowest frequency, the DC term right here, and then along this axis we have the Y spatial frequency. Along this axis we have the X. Now some of you may say, oh, well, that's all redundant. Maybe not. Maybe not. There are some other neat properties aside from the shift. This one's used a lot now in pattern recognition and object recognition. If you rotate the object, this is the Fourier transform of a rectangle, and it's got much, since it's smaller in the X direction, it will have a much broader spectrum, higher frequency terms, in the U direction. This is a low frequency in the vertical, and even though it looks like it's extending out, notice it's not as bright. It drops off. It's a lot dimmer here, which means it's got less energy in the high frequency. So narrow, lots of high frequency. Big, mostly concentrated in the low frequency. These are not Gonzalez's images. I took them from other books. But here's the really useful thing for a lot of image recognition applications. The Fourier transform axes rotate with the object. This is great, for example, if you're looking at things maybe underneath a camera, and you might have objects coming by on a conveyor belt. You just do the Fourier transform, and you find the axes, and bang, you know the orientation of the object. Now, there are other ways of doing it, but that could be done with a lens. It turns out you can do Fourier transforms optically. You don't just have to do them mathematically. Now, sometimes Fourier transforms and of the original object and the corresponding Fourier transform is hard to envision. In fact, for those of you who have ever seen one of Dr. Wilson's biomedical engineering image processing exams, he loves to put this question in. He'll give you a bunch of objects or images in the space domain, and here's a bunch of Fourier transforms over here. Which ones match up? Easy question to grade. Drives you nuts if you're a student. Okay, but let's see if we can explain some of these. The first one is if we, and these really should be the other way around, that we have white on black. Okay, but this came from another textbook. In general, if we have just one little circle, we will get a circular object. And that's because when we did the X and the Y, okay, we didn't have symmetry. With a circle, you have symmetry. And if you're really interested in this, under this symmetry, the sine functions and the cosines get replaced by Bessel functions. Technically, that is a Fourier-Bessel transform. When was the last time you used Bessel functions? Long, long, long time ago, if ever. Not one of those things that you really use every day. But the idea is a circularly symmetric object will give you a circularly symmetric transform. That's useful. This relates to some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier. Here is this would be a very narrow white box or line. Lots of high frequency in this direction because it's very narrow, remember. Lots and lots of high frequency. Here, this is low frequency. That, because it's very wide, that means that it's all going to be represented in close to the axis. Now, if you're not following what I'm saying, either talk to me after class or take a look at any introductory Fourier text. But you don't really need to understand this because the MATLAB and ImageJ routines will do all the computations for you. This is just to let you know that you can interpret those transforms and learn a lot from it. This is interesting right here. There are two effects. And this gets into convolution. Because what I have here are two dots. A single dot gives me this circularly symmetric pattern. What happens is I have superposition and, in effect, interference between the two. There is a frequency term associated with how far apart these are. That's what that is. It's periodic that way. Okay? But I still have that circular pattern from each one of these. Now, notice what happens. If I make it square so that I have frequency components that way and that way that repeat, if you see a grid, it means a repeating pattern. So, for example, if somehow you did a Fourier transform of one of those line markers, or lane markers, and it was a dashed line, you'd get something like that. Well, in one axis. And you can get more complicated things. Notice I changed this to little triangles. And what I see now is I have some frequency components associated with the basic pattern, but I've also picked up now frequency components associated with each of the edges of the patterns. And here we have a little diamond. And you can see that that's got, again, a pattern, a Fourier transform, which tells you something about the shape of the original object. You've got the frequency component and the angle between the axes of the object. I'll do one more slide and then let you go. Here's what happens if you look at a real-world object. Okay, sorry. I didn't have any roads, and you might want to put that image into a Fourier transform routine and see what happens. But this is an SEM of an integrated circuit with a connection sticking out here. And the question is, what does the Fourier transform of a real image look like? And this is just the Fourier spectrum, remember, the magnitude. Okay, and notice I have, which corresponds to all of the edges. They're like that, and they're like that. Now, and it shows up much better in your textbook than it does on here. There's actually another line right here. If you look at it, if you look closely, see? There's a dashed line running right here, right off of the axis. And that's due to this one. Notice that it's approximately perpendicular to it. Okay. And that's the high frequency. The spacing here actually tells you the width of it, and the angle tells you the orientation. The Fourier transform is good for a lot of things. Now, obviously, it's more difficult to interpret if you start to have a lot of objects in it. If you have a lot of objects, you can get much more complicated spectra than this. Okay? But it can be very good. It's a well-known thing. You can buy hardware which implements it. Okay. So we're in Chapter 4. And since you don't have any homework for a little while, and I will take a look at the web page that I still have it messed up, and I'll check with the images, but I may not be able to get you any additional images until Scott gets back from whatever he's doing. I don't know. He just said he'd be gone for a couple days, and it may be he took a very early fall break. Well, we'll have to let them know that we don't let graduate students take fall break. No. We expect you to spend full time working on Dexter. And if anyone wants to come in and work on Dexter over fall break, talk to us.